In the spring semester of 2009 at the University of Colorado at Boulder, I taught a course titled Brain-Body Movement. It was offered in the Department of Religious Studies, where I have been teaching since 1983. The primary intent of the lectures was to creatively contribute to our understanding of the bodied nature of being human and to extend how we may best take advantage of the many and diverse areas of research on brain, body, and movement. My primary academic and personal interest is in dancing. For many years, I've been a dancer, a dance teacher, and academically, I've studied dance traditions all over the world. My continuing work is to construct a powerful theory of dancing that allows us to use dancing as a comparative category for the study of cultures throughout the world. In these lectures, I often turn to dancing to provide a concrete example of how these many topics may be effectively used. Of course, the academic study of religion is also an ongoing concern. There are 14 lectures published as an ebook on my website, www.sam-gill.com. In each of the podcasts of this series, which parallel the published lectures, I focus on a single topic for discussion and exploration. I hope you enjoy all of these podcasts. The topic brain-body motion seems one of the last things that might be of interest to students of religion, and yet I presented the series of lectures that I'm going to talk about here to students at the University of Colorado. These were graduate students and seniors. It's important for me to provide a little bit of context here for you to understand why it's odd that these lectures would be appropriate for students of religion, but then, in another hand, why it seems to me to be very compelling that it be so. The series of lectures is certainly not limited to people that have interest in the study of religion. Nonetheless, that was the context in which these lectures were delivered, and I want to provide some background for you on that. The academic study of religion is a field that's not very well known among the general population. When you indicate to people that you're a student of religion, most people understand that you're a theologian and would consider you a religious person. The academic study of religion is really not based on the presupposition that one be religious or theological, for sure. Nonetheless, there's probably a pretty good reason why most people make the assumption that the study of religion in academic institutions is related to theology and to Christian studies, because that indeed was its heritage. The study of religion in universities developed and emerged from Christian studies and particularly biblical studies. In the 1960s, the U.S. Supreme Court made a distinction between teaching religion and teaching about religion. To teach religion in those days was to compel someone to be religious, to teach them in such a way that it made them religious. And this, of course, would be illegal under the constitutional provision of the separation of church and state. So this Supreme Court decision, 1964, I believe it was, made an important distinction in saying to teach about the subject religion was then not a violation of the separation of church and state, and to teach about religion was the same as teaching about any other subject. So that religion then is possible to teach in universities, but by being about religion, so that the comparative study of religion then developed strongly in the development of the academic study of religion in state-supported universities. And here, interestingly enough, biblical studies and certainly also theology stood in some sense as a prototype for that. So that biblical studies focuses on the interpretation of texts, being the biblical literature of Christianity and Judaism. So the comparative study of religions throughout the world was also a text-based study. And of course, as the study of texts, this then avoided actually studying the people directly themselves, so that they were studied in a bodied way, only to the degree that they were represented in texts. It seems, and has always seemed to me a little bit odd, that that Christianity has had a deep ambivalence regarding the body, and that's particularly given that Christianity itself is distinguished on the bodied incarnation of the deity, the Christ event, and then the killing and bodily resurrection of this God. The principal rite, the sacrament of the Eucharist, if you look at it in just simply sort of straight terms, is a kind of grisly affair that involves the eating of body and the drinking of blood. And these are highly bodied, highly sensuous, basically, activities. Nonetheless, throughout Christian history and certainly throughout much of Western philosophical history, the spirit is really understood as that which endures. It's dependable because it does not change. The body itself is subject to change because it ages and is corruptible by sin and so forth. Plato, early philosopher, Western philosopher, had a strong interest in ideal types, suggesting that these types, the invisible types, were really more real, more enduring than any manifestations. And of course, René Descartes, in his Cogito, I Think, Therefore I Am, indicated a strong Western preference for the minded, the thinking part over the body part. When we think about modern universities, and not only universities, but all Western educational institutions, we can see that the physical activities are commonly discouraged and devalued over the higher valuation of the mind. Even from our earliest childhood experiences, we were told as children to sit down and be quiet so that we might learn. Our educational spaces, if we look at them, are actually containers that isolate people in the learning environment from the ongoing activities of the world and of the culture, and use then books, read words, learned theories, exercises of the mind in order to learn and to come to knowledge about culture and that which is beyond. Nonetheless, the educational environment itself is usually made up of educational spaces that are isolating containers. When we think about even academic furniture tends to disable bodies, or certainly place bodies at rest. And academic furniture is usually set up in such a way that students are distinguished from teachers, and students are placed by their furniture in such a way that their eyes and ears are focused on the source of wisdom, which is then understood as the teacher. And it's only the teacher then who is given the permission to stand up and to walk about. At the University of Colorado, one of the principal sound bites is that one hears on television and radio is Colorado, University of Colorado distinguished itself by producing minds that match our mountains. And of course, we sit here at the foot of the Rocky Mountains, and I often joke with my students that maybe some students might think that meant minds that were high, but I think it really means lofty, high-minded, rather than high in certain other respects that might be more the experience of students. The minds actually are the products of all universities. Universities produce minds. It's interesting to think of our graduation exercises. We had one here just a couple of weeks ago, and we see long processions of academically garbed people, and the academic garb, which interestingly enough actually closely resembles liturgical garments, but academic garb, as you all know, are large flowing robes that basically render the body inarticulate. To move the feet and hands beneath the robe is almost undetectable. So that when you see then these large graduation exercises, than what you observe as is simply a sea of floating heads, with the face being the most predominant part of the body. I don't think it's a mistake that Western academic garb is very closely resembling religious vestments and so forth. So again, what we see is the tipping towards the mind. The face is the only part of the body that then seems to be of value and of significance, and the rest of the body is considered a gross body and simply serves as a kind of vehicle for the mind and for the head, which is most important. When we think of the stereotypical images of the intellectual, the scholar, these are relatively consistent throughout our culture. This is a figure that's typically bespectacled. It's a figure that's either quite slight and thin and feeble, or stout and has a pear-shaped body. The intellectual is usually unkempt, a scruffy facial hair. And often the intellectual exudes an air of distance, of removedness, of vagueness, of perhaps contemplation, and often, quite frankly, simply befuddlement as a bodied being in the world. We also recognize in the university a kind of significant distinction among those who are physically active, the body-oriented members of the academic community, and those who are mentally active. We can think of this, I suppose, valued in a couple of different ways. Athletes are certainly physically involved members of the academic community, yet as time has gone on, the athletic aspect of the university has become increasingly isolated, having their own buildings and their own facilities and their own playing fields and stadiums and arenas. And this becomes much more a publicity aspect of the university, as well as operating on its own budget. So athletics becomes a way of attracting a great deal of attention to a university, can be very important in terms of publicity, in terms of fundraising, in terms of goodwill, in terms of image, in terms of recognition, name awareness of a university. But there is often a great deal of discomfort between the athletic program and athletic and the academic programs. We have then sort of on the other side of those who are physically embodied, perhaps those we might think of in theater and dance. These, I think, are representatives of high culture, so that the dances that would most commonly be done would be ballet and certainly modern currently. And in the theater realm, this, of course, represents the literature of the theater, so that these aspects that are bodied parts of the university, body-oriented parts of the university, are closely associated with high culture, where the athletic departments usually thrive and have very large budgets. On the other hand, the dance and theater departments typically struggle a great deal to have any presentation at all in the university. And then it's actually quite interesting that in our production-oriented society, things like dance and theater have had to present themselves not simply as works of art, but and actually I just reflected that right there, but as works. So other than simply body activities, they have to make productions and produce things, produce dancers and produce plays and produce shows. And this then incorporates them into the economic productive orientation that is so powerful and important to the university. So that this is the background against which I wanted to present these lectures. We have then a sense of the university being tipped very strongly towards valuing the mind. And in the very specific context of this course, we have the university's academic study of religion tipped toward texts and the presentation of bodied cultures through the representation in texts. so that what we then are recognizing is that body, brain, movement, these are not only underrepresented in terms of the studies of religion, but also actually throughout the whole university. The university, the Western educational system itself, is built on a tendency towards a denying of the body and of movement in preference to disembodied mental activities. So that in this presentation of lectures, it's been important for me to mine the literature that has developed extensively in the last 50 years to 100 years, and increasingly so during the last 50 years, to show that movement, body, brain activities are absolutely fundamental to what it is and what it means to be a human being, and that for us to remain ignorant of these discoveries is for us to shortchange in a really major way the activities that we currently call the academic study of religion and simply academic human studies. So that the objective will be to look at the findings that have been related to the importance and how the brain functions, how movement is fundamental to what it means to be human, and then that will allow us to see ourselves as embodied beings in this context of the educational environment. So I wanted at this point then simply to present this as a background so that we understand that in presenting these talks, we both understand the absence of the attention that has been directed towards the subject matter that I'm going to present, and furthermore, how vitally important it is that we begin to include not only simply as one additional bit of information, but as information absolutely fundamental to us in understanding what it means to be a human being, and therefore in our studies of everything that we do that is related to being human. I think actually, and I will press this more and more as we go on through these talks, that this really amounts not simply to a subtle compliment to what we have done, but it actually presents a challenge to revolutionize the way we understand not simply the academic study of religion, but the way we understand the academic enterprise itself. So I will then begin to work through a large number of topics here in the talks that are to come. But in this presentation, I wanted to give you simply a little background on why we're doing this and its urgency. Thank you for listening to this volume of Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series by the same title. I am making this lecture series in print form available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. Thank you very much for listening to this volume, and I'll be talking to you again later. Bye-bye.